Welcome to the podcast, The Caring Scientist, Mission Sustainable. This is the podcast where we discuss sustainability in science and we give you hands-on tips on how you can reduce the environmental impact of your lab work. Welcome to this episode of our podcast. My name is Nicoline and I am the only host in the room today, but we are actually now three hosts on the program. So it's still Adriana and myself, and then we have someone new on board, and that's Aluce. So that's super nice. And in the next episode, you'll hear Adriana and Aluce on another topic on sustainability in science. Today, it's me and then a special guest who knows a lot of stuff about slow science, which I think is a really cool concept that we should definitely discuss in this podcast. So welcome to you, Luisa Maria Díaz de Vegas. I was wondering if you could start with introducing yourself and your background. Where are you sitting in the world and what kind of research are you doing?
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm currently in Brazil. I'm from Brazil, actually. My name is Luisa. I'm currently a visiting professor at the Federal University of Bahia here in Brazil. And I am an ecologist, so I work evaluating the impacts of our activities on biodiversity, mainly focused on climate change and reptiles and amphibians and other organisms as well. So this is my main line of research, but I also do research on the gender biases in academia, and not only gender, but well, the intersectional approach focus on biases in academic environment. So within this topic, I have been working on different subjects, trying to understand how our cultural background can affect the way we do science and the way we receive people from different backgrounds into the academic environment.
Super interesting and super important as well. I mean, like with so many other sectors, it's very dominated by white males at a certain age. And of course, that's also impacting the way we are being peer reviewed, for example, I can imagine, and the way we are perceived as scientists.
Exactly, yeah. That's exactly what happened.
And the reason why I asked if you wanted to speak to me today is because you also know things about slow science, which I think is a super interesting topic. Maybe you can explain to me, what is fast science? What is slow science?
Sure. Yeah. So fast science is basically the way our academic system is based. It's basically the idea of publish or perish. So we need to publish more and more, and we need to publish it fast. So we need to do science fast, because the metrics that evaluate the quality of the scientists are basically quantitative, but we don't focus on the healthy way of doing science. So on the other hand, the slow science movement is exactly the opposite. It's the idea that we must do science in a slower way and focus on the quality of our work and of our health. So the slow science movement try to fight this idea of publish or perish.
Super nice. Can you explain to me what are the negative consequences of fast science being the standard?
Sure. Usually in our biased academic environment, this fast science is developed to directly empower the ones that are already on the top, which are usually the white cisgender male. You know, so it's basically the speed of science is directly related to the structures of power and inequality that shape our society. So because of fast science, we have the imposter syndrome, we have impacts on our mental health, we also have what we call the salami science, which is basically we get like a super cool project, and instead of publish one paper with one big and relevant paper, we break it into small pieces just to get the numbers. And when we just break it into smaller pieces, we are not doing the best science we can.
Mm. Super good points.
Yeah, and so therefore, the fast science, it rewards fast-paced science and excludes those scientists who doesn't fit that profile. So mothers, caregivers that are not only focused on being a scientist, or even underrepresented groups as a whole, because we have these different issues along our careers, and also introspective people.
Mm. So even though the quality of their research can be splendid, they might not fall into the category of what we call successful researchers today.
Exactly, yeah.
I think the reason why I sort of also really liked and still like the concept of slow science is because to me it really addresses a lot of the problems with academia as it is today. I mean, you were mentioning salami science, like we slice stories up in many stories so we can get more out of them, instead of focusing on would this fit better as one story? Would that be a better way to present the science that we did? And you mentioned mental health. Like fast science is putting so much pressure on researchers, and we obviously do have problems with mental health in academia. We've also seen scientific studies on that. And then I think something that is sort of the connection to, let's say, the ecologically more sustainable science is fast science is also sort of pushing people to sometimes maybe skip a few corners and make a lot of irreproducible science, not necessarily because people are bad scientists or don't have good intentions, but they're under such a pressure that they might not be doing their research super well, or they might not do the right controls or test things enough. And then papers are being published, which contains irreproducible results. Other labs will then try to reproduce that. And in that whole series of events, a lot of planetary resources are lost. Every time we make an experiment that isn't working out, that's a waste of resources, but that's how it goes in science. We do a lot of stuff that don't work. But when we start publishing something that doesn't work and say, these are the results, it's working, we see these whatever connections between, let's say, drugs and diseases, when others start reproducing things or trying to reproduce things that are not true, then that's really a waste of resources, of course. And also coming back to like papers and mental health issues, the more papers are being produced in my field, the more I have to read. And it turns out that many of those papers are not even, like, you can't even trust the results. And that's putting more pressure on people in terms of time. I have to read a lot of crap. So I think this whole connection with both, like, the planetary resources we're using in the science, the mental health issues in science, and of course also all of the people who are just not, yeah, able to live up to all of those weird criteria we have today for science. I think slow science is, it's just making a lot of sense in many ways.
For sure it is. Yeah, the idea, the slow science movement, it was born as a call for a better and healthier scientific culture. So it's a way to fight the system that encourages quantity over quality. It's a way to try to change that.
Mm.
But of course, it's not easy to do that. We need to understand that we are humans. We need other things that only just sit and write and do whatever we need to publish crap things, because we don't have time to do better things, you know.
Mm. I remember this one situation back when I was doing an internship somewhere. I'm not going to go into details. And instead of talking about what would be the most interesting story, like what would be the most interesting knowledge to sort of produce here, the question was rather, what would be the most easy, quick story to publish? I mean, it's very symptomatic. It's not because anything was wrong with those researchers. I just thought it was so sad, instead of being like, what intrigues me, or what is the most valuable knowledge we can create from this study, it was more like, what's the most easy thing that we can quickly publish, and then we'll take it from there.
Yeah.
I was thinking maybe you already sort of touched upon it, but what are the factors driving fast science? Why do we see fast science happening everywhere?
In my experience in Brazil, we have one thing that is the most, I think is the most important, which is the lack of resources for science. So those who publish more, they will have, they are more likely to get the money to do science. And also here in Brazil, we usually do science into the universities, federal universities, state universities, the public universities. Those are the main research institutions. But for us to be in these universities, in these institutions, the curriculum is the most important part of the selection process.
So the number of publications you had, basically.
Exactly. So our evaluation the quality of our science is based on the number of published articles and the impact factor. And I think I'm talking about my experience in Brazil, but this is recurrent in other places as well. So I think that's the most important part. And then we have another issue that you didn't mention, but it's also related to that, with are the predatory journals. Because we pay to publish, and we paid a really expensive fees to publish in these journals, and because they are being more common, their impact factors are rising, but they're not really good scientific journals, because they're basically, you just need to pay and then your research will be published. So it's another issue that is also related to this fast science.
Yeah, it's really a complex matter, right? It's like the reasons are many, and the solutions are maybe simple, but it doesn't mean they are easy to implement, because like with so many other important things we have to deal with at this time, it's a whole system we would need to change. So what would it take to change the system? Like, what exactly do we need to change? You said something about, for example, the way we get funding is based on how much we publish, not how well we publish, and also all the other important things you could do as a researcher. What do we need to do to change the system, or what would need to happen to have slow science as a standard?
First of all, we need to understand that this way of doing science is directly related to this structure of power. And we need to recognize that and change that. We need to break the persistence of this ignorance that, I didn't know that this was happening, or, well, there's not gender bias in my lab or in my institute. I am talking about slow science, but I'm also talking about diversity and inclusion, because these are connected. We need to acknowledge that something is wrong. We are not doing good science. We are not promoting diversity in our academic environment. We are excluding people from different groups that should be doing science as well. This is also important, because we think better when we think diverse. So people think differently. And when we think differently, we can create, we can think about different questions, we can think about different lines of research, and we can think about different resolutions. So we need to improve this inclusion to have this diversity of thoughts in the academic environment. So stimulate this entry of underrepresented groups, fight racism, misogyny, transphobia, every form of discrimination inside the academic environment, so people can actually think about science instead of just thinking about surviving. And when talking specifically about the slow science movement, we need to change the metrics, the quantitative metrics that keep this this academic system going as it is. So what are these these quantitative metrics? So what makes me a good scientist? Is just the number of my papers, or is the way I advise my students? Is the way I give my classes? Is the way I can collaborate with different people from different backgrounds? All those things must be acknowledged when we are talking about metrics to determine the quality of a researcher. Evaluating the quality instead of quantity. I think that's the most important part. And for considering funding for research, who gets the funding? How is the process to get the funding? It's always come back to the central point, which is the quantitative metrics. These quantitative metrics are the most important part that we need to change, because we have these quantitative metrics to receive the funding. We have these quantitative metrics to get a tenure position. We have these same metrics to get grants or fellowships or whatever. So changing the quantitative metrics, thinking about these metrics in a more human way, that would be the best way for us to actually reach a better science, a better way of doing science, a more just and a more inclusive way of doing science.
Mm. I'm also thinking, I mean, you mentioned a few of the things here, right? Like the quality of the research rather than how many papers you had and how the impact factors of those papers were. Also, are you a good teacher? Are you a nice PhD supervisor? Are you engaging with the public? I mean, outreach is super important. I mean, we've seen that, like, there's so much skepticism about science in many ways, which has really detrimental consequences, right? So there's so many things that makes a researcher a good researcher, right? And that's just not being taken into account at the moment. Who has the responsibility to change this? Is it the funding bodies, the universities going together to call for, like, a different paradigm within science? Or where should it start? Which are the stakeholders that should take part in this?
I believe that the first step must be from the those who are leading, right? So the funding agencies, they must start to rethink about the way they are giving their money. Also in the institutions, those who are in power inside the institution, so the direction, the committees, the directors, they must start to think about it. But here's the thing. They will only think about it if they are those who already experienced these issues.
Because they were born and raised in that culture, so why would they ask for a different culture, in a way?
Exactly. Okay, I'm talking about slow science, but we need to focus on diversity and inclusion in academia. We need to get this diversity inside academia. We need to get this into the leadership positions.
Mm.
I am the co-founder of two networks of women in science in Brazil. And we have people from all parts of the academic career. And we need that. We need to include and provide these people support so they can actually occupy these places and then start to change it. We have some good examples of changes that are already occurring. It's slow, but it's happening.
Nice. I think that's also really important to keep in mind that there are so many important things we're dealing with that is just not going to change overnight. It's like, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. We need to keep asking for these things, need to keep fighting for them. And then one day, hopefully it will work out, but we can't expect it to change in half a year or a year. Would be great if it would, but like, we have to constantly challenge the system. I think maybe the problem here is also the people who don't fit into the current fast science paradigm, they leave science, right? So they don't stay to fight the system from within. They think, this is not for me. That's also what I thought, right? This is not for me. I don't fit in here. It's not a system that I like. So that also sort of, it's selecting for people who are fine, or at least accepting of the system, and then they reproduce that system. So it's so important that there are people like you who are fighting the system, but also staying in that system, because it's hard to be outside and asking for change when you don't actually have the influence in a university, for example, to say, hey, the people in charge of like promoting people or whatever, they need to take this into account.
Exactly. You need to be in the system to fight the system. But yeah, we try to avoid that people just give up. I advise some masters and PhD students, and I try to make them comfortable to do their projects in their pace. And I think that's another thing that is important. The mentors must be supportive. Mm. And the mentors must understand their role as mentors, not as bosses. They must understand the particularities of their mentees.
Mm. I think that bridges very well to my last question for you, which is, what can people actually do? I mean, I know that there are some very powerful people who could do a lot if they wanted to, but for all the people who are just, let's say, regular researchers at any level, it could be undergrads, it could be PhD students, it could be postdocs, professors, whatever. Like, what can people actually do to promote slow science? I mean, so you were saying, as a mentor, like, remember, you are a mentor, not just a boss, and support everyone that is sort of, let's say, under your wings. But what else can one do to support the slow science movement?
I think who is already in positions, in tenure positions inside the system, these people has, I will use the term duty, but you know what I mean. They have the duty to actually ask for change within the institution. So we can do that. We can do these suggestions inside our institutions. Also, in our lab, we can always try to make this a more inclusive place, making people comfortable to be there and feeling that they can occupy these places. Because one of the things that we have because of our science is the imposter syndrome. They don't believe they are fit to be scientists. So we can make them to believe that by creating a good lab environment. So be supportive. I think that's the most important thing that we can do. Be supportive to the different issues that people face on their daily lives. Everybody has their own demons.
Yeah.
Try to change the system considering our local experience, so our lab, our institute, our university.
Very nice. I think it's I think you're saying a lot of really important things there, and I think the word local here, I think that's also really important, because sometimes we think if we want to change the system, there are only very few people who can do it, and those are the people in top of the system, those with the most power. But I don't think a system ever changed because the people with the most power just one day woke up and decided to do that. I think all of the big systematic changes we've had, they have started probably from bottom up. People asking for change, and I think also just the local change, what is the environment like in your department, in your lab, but also maybe just starting the conversation maybe even at the lunch table where there are many different people, like hopefully different at different career steps, like discussing it, fast science, slow science, what's wrong with the system, what would a great system look like, what would be the things that I would like to be evaluated on as a scientist. And of course, if you have influence on committees that actually make decisions, like on who gets hired, who doesn't, and who gets a tenure position, who doesn't, like try to get that agenda in there as well. And then maybe if you're in some way engaging with funding bodies, or, and of course, if it doesn't like harm you or your career, maybe also drop the question, like, how are they thinking about the system which is being used for evaluating scientists at the moment? And do they have any thoughts or any things ongoing to change that? And yeah. But thank you so much for offering some advice on what everyone in principle could do to support this, so we don't just lean back and say, oh, hopefully one day the people in power will change this.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Nicoline. It was really nice to talk to you.
Thank you so much for coming and for bridging all of these important topics, both planetary resources, irreproducible science, mental health, the lack of diversity in the academic environment and all of this. It was a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much for listening. And if you want to get in touch, please feel free to email us at podcast@avasustain.com. That is podcast@avasustain.com. We have also put this email address and other useful links in the notes below this podcast. Till next time.